This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. I'm here with Graham Ewing. Graham, how are you?
I'm doing well.
How are you? Or you go by Graham sometimes, too. Well, Graham, it's great to have you tonight, and you wanted to do this show with me tonight because you were the one that suggested that we do this author in this book, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And want to tell everyone who we have with us tonight?
Yes, tonight we have Chris White. He is a CFA. He's a senior investment counselor at Hemingway Trust Company, a New Hampshire chartered wealth management firm. He's an experienced wealth management advisor and strategist, and he has invested on behalf of individuals, couples, families, and institutions for more than 25 years. And he's the author of the book tonight that we're going to talk to him about, Emotional Investor Financial Psychology. And he's here to talk to us about how we all might not act as rationally and logically about investments as we think.
I agree, and it's a good point. And Chris, are you there with us?
I am indeed. Thank you very much for having me on board.
Well, we're glad to have you because I think this is a very important topic, and we have a saying at the Financial Consulate that the foundation of all financial planning is not money, it's not your pension, it's not your investments, it's this. What you think about money will determine everything you will do with and for money. What do you think? Is that a good foundation to lead a company with?
I couldn't agree more. The it's the values that we hold dear that drive our opinions about who we are and how we're doing and how happy we are.
Yeah, and what we found great about your book is that people are making financial decisions on a daily basis, be it in investing or be it in their way they spend money and so forth. And if you don't understand the psychology of what you're doing, you could easily be making mistakes and think you're doing great. You could be making mistakes of being way too aggressive and actually be making money for a while. But then ultimately it falls apart somewhere along the way. Or you could be way too conservative and so forth. And that's what your book talks about here, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, bottom line, all investing is emotional. And so the more that we understand about ourselves, the better we are in terms of harnessing that and using it and enhance our abilities to make decisions.
Yeah, you had a great line here in the book, and it was one of the very first ones I picked up on. It says, when it comes to money, people are complicated. You want to explain that a little more for us?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we could take the whole show up on that one, I think.
We sure could. That's right. So over the last 25-plus years of doing this with individuals, I started noticing that, first of all, there's that emotional component, and we are very complicated emotionally. It got me thinking, and I reached out to a psychologist up here in Boston, in Cambridge, David Cantor, and worked closely with him. He had developed some models on how people behave. And there are essentially three different personality types that he identified. I took those models and I applied them to investing. And I can go in at length with those.
Yeah, we're going to definitely do that, right? That's the fixer, the survivor, and the protector, right?
And the protector, that's right. But in addition to that, there are really two worlds that we all live in, and that's the low-stakes world of everyday life. You go to the grocery store, and unless you've forgotten your credit card, it's an easy thing to do and pay for the food and go home. But the high-stakes world is what we really focus on in investing because that's where people start to get a little bit nervous because they're committing their capital, they're committing their hard-earned money to the markets, and it's always a little bit nerve-wracking to do that. And then when the market starts to get volatile, we all go crazy. And the trick is to talk ourselves back from being on the ledge and try to be a little bit more sane.
And you know as well as I do, Chris, that you could have three or four or five investors in front of us. We could give them the exact same talk. We could explain the exact same logic to all five, but all five of them are going to react differently to the information we give them.
Definitely, definitely. So it means that in working with individuals, or if you're doing this on your own, you really need to understand yourself, and you need to custom tailor what it is you're doing according to your own emotional makeup. And the book goes into a lot of material that helps you understand that better.
So what we're going to talk about when we come back, we've got about a minute to go. We're going to talk about the three personality types, I guess you call them, a fixer, survivor, protector. Then we're going to also talk about the communication style, the effect communication style, the power communication style, and the meaning communication style. And then if I understand it correctly, then there's a third level, and that's called the style of engagement. Some people are open, some people are closed, and some people are random. And these are important to understand, which are you and how do you operate, because it'll help you to understand why you make the decisions you make.
And they also, when you begin to understand these dynamics, you can also more easily identify who you are and what drives you in your decision-making. So they're very useful concepts, and whether you're using it for yourself or interpersonal relationships or how you relate to the market.
Yeah, and when we come back, you know, one of the reasons I find this type of stuff, I've been doing personality types for years, is it helps me to understand maybe who my wife is or who Graham is or who other people are, and now I stop trying to get them to be like me and I allow them to be them. And I appreciate them for who they are and no longer want them to be like me. So that's a beauty of personality types, I think. And anyway, we're going to talk about that more, Chris, when we come back from this pause in traffic. But right now, we got to turn it over to traffic. Take it away, traffic.
Personal finance has become a major area of stress due to the increasing dangers and complexities of the global economy. Personal financial management is a comprehensive approach to combating these issues, and the financial physical is the first step. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, an independent fee-only firm. The financial physical begins with an objective analysis of your personal finances and ends with a plan to help achieve your goals. Experience the difference of the financial physical and learn how personal financial management can revolutionize your financial well-being. To learn more about the financial physical and the other services we offer, call us at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-7283. Or the easy way to remember that, 410-823-SAVE. Or visit us online at DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com.
Hello?
Beach Boys. I would have never guessed that. That's just because I know only two bands.
Chris,
you know?
Do you like the Beach Boys?
Chris White, do you like the Beach Boys?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're summertime. We love summertime.
Did you know that was the Beach Boys?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, see there? It goes. Just shows how musically inclined I am there, Graham.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
it just tells you how old I am.
I'm the same age as you, though. That's the problem. Anyway.
I'm not, though.
You're not even close,
yeah.
Graham.
So, Chris, you talk about, or Drew and I, you know, meet with clients and, you know, see friends and family, and we've all got our own kind of quirks around money. And
not true, of course.
and a lot of that, we've seem to find comes from their childhood. You have experiences when you're younger. You have things happen to you that you carry into adulthood. And you talk about that a little bit in your book.
Definitely. So a lot of this, a lot of our feelings about loss and love, which many people confuse with gain and money, you know, accumulation, all come from childhood roots. And again, David Cantor's psychological models show that, and this is based on decades of research that he did on individuals and families, that somewhere around ages 8 to 10, people, children, suddenly realize that they're no longer the center of attention. And they're no longer, you know, the apple of their mom's eye or their dad's eye. And that is what David called the loss of perfect love. And we spend adolescence recovering from that blow. And we draw on teachers and mentors and friends to give us feedback in terms of what it is that we deserve credit for, attention for, what it is we're good at. And from that feedback, we begin to evolve into personality types. So that by the time we're in our early 20s, mid-20s, we're done with adolescence, we have figured out that we are one of these three personality types.
So let me ask you a quick question here, Chris. And, you know, because I saw you said that in the book, and I just have this question. Is there a possibility that people are birthed with a birth personality type and our childhood history just massages it over time? Because you know how you meet a 5 3-year-olds and they're all in the same situation. They've all had a similar background of growing, but the one's running out there and jumping over, you know, tables and things, and the other one's sitting there quietly, and the other one's kind of standing around and observing and so forth. Do you think there's a possibility that we're birthed with them and then our childhood experiences massage those core roots?
Well, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I'm a psychologist.
I'm not going to sit here and say it either, but
so that's indeed possible that there are inklings of the personality type that you will end up being from early on. But time and time again, David saw in these childhood stories from adults something significant that happened. You know, it might be that, you know, that your parents had a surprise child born when you were 8 years old, and suddenly you were no longer getting all the attention.
I do have a younger sister.
That
sounds familiar.
That's it. What's her name?
Abigail.
So she's out there listening
Abigail,
right now.
She changed the tables on you.
She did.
Grandma's always said that. Oh, if only Abigail.
Drew,
you know?
You got a younger sister too, right?
I have two of them, actually.
Two.
But,
yeah.
You know, so it definitely affected me. But, you know, you talk about the prospect theory, which is, I guess, that we feel losses far deeper than we appreciate gains.
Yes. So that was a critical paper that came out, and it turned the world of economics upside down and really introduced this concept of behavioral economics or behavioral finance, because Tversky and Kahneman, who did a lot of their research in the 70s and 80s, wrote a paper in 1991 called The Prospect Theory, and in that they identified this concept of loss aversion, where the grief or pain derived from a loss of a dollar was twice as painful as the pleasure derived from the gain of a dollar. And that just blew the economic theories out of the water, because prior to that it was assumed that the pain would be equal to the pleasure in whether you lost or gained a dollar. So, and in fact, in subsequent research, a lot of people have found that the pain can be 3, 4, 5 times as severe as the pleasure is from the gain of a dollar.
Well, there's no doubt that the driving force of most investors, of all investors for the most part, not, you know, is greed and fear. And that they've always said that fear is the one that impacts the investment world far more than greed.
Indeed. Now, until you get into the world of, say, 1999, or who knows, maybe even today, when, you know, the market just keeps going up, 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 and you're worried that you're not going to keep up with your neighbor, and that's where the greed kicks in, and you start making foolish decisions because you don't want to lose out if your best friend is making tens and tens of thousands of dollars on his investments. You got to get in there and get it too. So fear and greed, you know, Mr. Buffett was right. Fear and greed are major, major drivers. And those emotions are so powerful because we tie them up with this concept of loss and our confusion of love seeking money to be the solve and be the love that we perhaps never really got.
See, now, Graham has a personal story that was in your book. He's very familiar with it. Solera. Go ahead, Graham.
Yeah, so, Chris, you talked about Solera in the book. My father actually worked for Solera during that time. They were mapping the human genome, and they were in a race to finish first, and then they ended up tying. But you talk about anticipation and completion.
Right. Right. So, very, very powerful. So it's sort of like the old saw that you want to buy when you hear the sound of gunfire starting. So, you know, the market in 2003 when the Iraq War started, it was that initial attack. The market took off, and of course, you know, we won the war. But the market had already rallied tremendously prior to that, simply because by the sound of that gunfire, people anticipated that great things were going to happen. So it's almost sort of a letdown emotionally when Solera or finally announces that they've got the magical cure. People are disappointed.
Yeah. You know, if I remember correctly, according to your book, and I looked it up, Solera went up like, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 fold during the anticipation. But when they actually announced we've done it, it went down 20% in like a few days.
Right. And you know, maybe it's a little bit like that, the kiss that you get after the prom night or something.
Well, they always say, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news, you know.
That's right, exactly.
And that's exactly what you're referring to, anticipation and completion. And so investors have to know where you are in a cycle and make sure that you're not just getting in on the cliff with the other lemmings. Right now, we've got to take that next pause, Chris, but you hold on with us. We're going to go see what's happening with traffic. We're going to be right back with money, riches, and wealth. Take it away, traffic.
75% of adults agree they could benefit from advice and answers to everyday financial questions from a professional. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consult. We strive to serve as a leader in educating the public on personal finance topics through our Financial Pulse and Consulate Journal. For these publications and learn about our personal financial management services, visit our website at drewtig.com, drewtig.com, and follow us on Twitter at the FinCon for educational updates.
Beetles. Birds. I was close.
The birds.
Chris, did you know that?
The birds, of course.
Come on, Chris, you're making me look bad. You know, you and I are the same age. I have no idea who these bands are.
What were you doing in the 60s? Well, we won't go there.
I was a good kid. I was a very good kid, sort of, maybe. A little bit, you know. You're turning 60 this year, yes? Is that what you said?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I'm 66.
You're 60, so you're older then. I'm turning 60 this year.
Oh, you're a youngin'.
Yeah, really. There you go. So there, that's why I don't know these bands. let's look at, you know, this is Chris White we're talking to. His book, The Emotional Investor, Financial Psychology for Wealth Managers, is talking about, you know, why do investors do what they do? And if you're a wealth manager, you better understand why clients react the way they do. But, you know, a lot of our listeners are do-it-themselfers. And if they're going to be doing it themselves, they better understand their psychology of what they're doing. And so, Chris, you're talking about the three types, fixers,
yes,
survivors, and protectors. Now's the time that I think we better get into. We're in the second half of the show. Let's figure out what are these types. What's a fixer? That's like General Patton, you said.
Yes, that's right. Today, in fact, I mean, we've got the politicians have lined up well on this. So a fixer would be someone like Mr. Trump, a protector.
You're not allowed to say that.
No?
You're not allowed to say that. He doesn't fix anything. Anyway, go ahead, Chris.
Okay. You just press the bleep button when I say something wrong. Protector would be someone like Secretary Clinton, and the survivor would be someone like President Obama. So let me go into some examples. So a fixer is someone who loves to go in. You know, a fixer is usually someone like a CEO who loves to go in there and correct the situation. They tend to operate on a language of power and control. So those are those communication and engagement dynamics that you were mentioning earlier. And they can be very charming in low stakes. We talked about those two worlds of low stakes and high stakes. But when things really start getting tough, they can be very controlling and manipulative. So some of your listeners may say, that's Mr. Trump.
No. This is a radio station where you probably want to stay away from politics. Let's stick with General Patton, Sir Ernest Shackleton, and Mother Teresa.
All right. Okay. So, but the fixer has to win at all costs. And so they tend to be risk takers. If the market sells off, they're often in there at the start when the market first sells off. They're often in there wanting to double up in their position. And what I've found with fixers is that you often have to talk them back from doing that, because they'll often want to pull the trigger, so desperate to make their whatever loss they might have into a gain. They want to pull the trigger too early. So so if an individual knows that he or she is a fixer, they need to talk to themselves, say, I need to calm down here, take a deep breath, and take a look and make sure that the market has bottomed out here.
And then the survivor.
So let me go to the protector.
Okay.
The protector tends to be risk averse. The protector loves to take care of people around them, but they also can feel very anxious, and they often anticipate problems before they show up. So if you have a client who's a protector, sometimes that protector will flag issues that you might not have thought of, and you want to listen to what they're saying. So they anticipate threats, but in the darkest times, when things are really tense and the market is sold off, they will feel powerless and even like a victim. And that's where the risk aversion comes in. They want to sell everything. And so the advisor, or if you are a protector and you're managing your own money, you got to talk to yourself about, the signal that I want to sell everything is probably also the time that the market is well washed out, and I really want to be doing exactly the opposite of what my gut is telling me to do. The final one is the survivor, who I'd say is sort of risk indifferent. They are so committed to a cause, like Ernest Shackleton, who's the explorer, that they are so committed to the cause, they're stoics. But as things get really tough, they can even become, so absorbed in their cause that they forget about what's going on around them. In the darkest times, they even abandon the people that they love. But they will sometimes just totally ignore their portfolios and choose not to make any changes when, in fact, they'd be better off to be making changes.
Sir Ernest Shackleton was the first one to go to the North Pole, is that it?
South Pole.
So it was one of the poles. I mean, what's the difference, north or south, you know? I guess there's a big difference.
They're both a little cold.
But it is a fascinating story of his expedition and so forth and what he left behind and so forth. So and if you understand the story, I obviously don't because I didn't know which pole he went to.
Well, it was cold anyway.
It was very cold, but he sacrificed a lot to get there and finalize that trip, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So this is interesting that you're talking about this. And, you know, one of the things I've noticed about great investors, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, Warren Buffett or Ray Dalio, who's an incredible, or Paul Tudor Jones, they all have incredible track records. They all tend to have one thing in common, and that is they have a strategy, a logical strategy that they follow to minimize the gut reaction to things.
Right. So you can use your gut reaction as a telltale sign of where your gut is and your brain, your thinking is, but then you got to talk yourself back from that. Say, okay, thank you very much, gut. Thank you, shoulders, for nodding up. Now I need to be logical here. So it's just a great feedback mechanism, a tool for you to use to alert you that you may be making the wrong decision right now, and you got to talk yourself back because you know you're a fixer and you're risk seeking, or you're a protector and you're risk averse, and you're about to make that wrong decision.
Yeah, you know, you take Warren Buffett, you know, you watch how he, like, bought IBM, and he bought IBM, and he held IBM, and he held IBM, and he held IBM. All along, he's analyzing it and thinking it, and he knows the logic of why he bought it and so forth. And whether he's making money or not making money is totally irrelevant to him. He had a philosophy as to why he was buying it, and he kept buying it until his analysis started to change. And when it started to change, he started to sell it. Whereas you go back years ago when he bought Geico at like 12, and he kept buying it and buying it and buying it as it went all the way down to 4 because his analysis kept telling him, well, I don't care what everyone else is doing. My logic and why I do what I do is saying continue to hold this stock. And he did, and ultimately bought the whole company out for, what, $360 or something a share compared to the average of about 6 that he ended up in his cost basis.
Yeah.
And he's got two rules, right? Rule number one, don't lose money.
Right.
Rule number two, don't forget rule number one.
And if you look at how he bought IBM, he knew that $160 or so a share, that the stock was worth every nickel of $160, and if he had got out, he'd get out at about break even. And that's, you know, so, but he continued to analyze it, so he had a logic as to why he did things. And that's what I think great investors do, and average investors use these psychological and emotional things to drive their decision-making. But you're going to answer that when we come back, Chris, because right now we have to take our final pause with traffic, and we're going to come right back and finish up some of the other important understandings of understanding your emotional investing things that are impacting your investing. Anyway, take it away, traffic. We'll be right back. And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Chris White, who wrote the book Emotional Investor, and that's what we're talking about. But Chris, I know that you, as well as our firm, the Financial Consulate, you have compliance issues, and I know you have to give a little bit of a disclaimer about your talk today. So go ahead and tell them, and then also tell everyone how they can stay in touch with you if they want to learn more about your topic of Emotional Investor.
Oh, thank you. So I just wanted to say that the opinions I'm expressing are mine and not those of my employer, Hemingway Trust Company. So these are all my ideas, my opinions. And the website is chriswhiteauthor.com. Chris White, C-H-R-I-S-W-H-I-T-E, author.com. And there's a lot of material on there, including a couple of videos and white papers, so good stuff there.
So it's chriswhiteauthor.com. So that's great.
Correct.
That's pretty simple. chriswhiteauthor.com. And
we try to keep it simple.
You too. Go ahead, Graham.
So, Chris, before the break, you talked about how, you know, a lot of us use emotion or our intuition first, and then we should try and step back and use a little bit more of logic. And I know in the book, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman that you were talking about earlier in the show, they talk about that, how we have two different systems, and that first system is really where emotion is kind of driving the car there, and a lot of it comes from biases, shortcuts that we sometimes take. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in fact, there's an appendix in the back of the book that gives an example of those shortcuts, and I talk about two different steel companies. This is back in the early 90s. Nucor, which I was pushing for as an analyst, and the portfolio manager said, no, this is when steel prices were about to jump up, said, no, we want to get the most beaten down, ugliest company out there. He wanted to buy Bethlehem Steel. And, he was running a mutual fund, and he was absolutely right. The reason was that everyone would go out and buy the steel company that they knew, that they were familiar with. No one had heard of Nucor, but everyone had heard about Bethlehem Steel, and it was cheap. So
how do we identify these biases in ourselves and try and overcome them when we're investing and making investment decisions?
Well, so it's important to always be looking at your thinking with sort of a third ear or a third eye. You have to step outside of yourself and say, now, what's driving my decision here? Why am I wanting to do that? Because our decisions are littered with biases, and you have to develop a degree of objectivity about your thinking, and so you can be more rigorous. And rather than just, making a snap decision that you think is right and trusting your gut. So, once again, it means stepping back, checking that gut feeling and doing a little bit more quantitative or rigorous thinking about why it is that you're making a decision.
So, Chris, the mission statement of our company is to help people lessen the worry and burden of money management so they can focus on something more important than just money, and that's relationships, because relationships tend to get destroyed by money more than anything else. And this is right in line with what you're talking about. Too many people, all they want to do is make a little more money, and they don't really think about the full implications of what they're doing. And you talk about this at the end of your book as to, what is happiness? Is happiness making another $1,000 or $100,000? And answer is to that is some people might think so, but ultimately ends up being a false hope. What do you see as the true path that we should be following?
Well, I'm going to leave that up to the individual, but what I have observed is that having some extra money is nice, but what's important is, and this has occurred time and time again with my clients, as they get into their 70s and 80s, they come to me and say, Chris, we want to forget the budget that we had worked on with you. We want to go out and we want to spend $10,000 to go on a trip. And I say, go for it. I've learned over time, go for it, because that experience will be far more important to them 5 years from now, while they're still alive or when one of them is dying, than having an extra $10,000 in the bank account or the portfolio. So, there are many things that are more important than just the bank account.
And you talk about it, you call it the, I think you call it the happiness advantage. What is that?
Yes. Well, a lot of it has to do with bottom line, gratitude, which I know is I didn't learn about gratitude in business school, I'll tell you that. But gratitude is an essential part, and you can tell that, and you can observe couples, for instance, who are happy. And bottom line, they're often grateful for the gifts they've received, their good fortune in having some extra money, and that they're not all about trying to get, you know, go out and make an extra buck. It's being content with who you are and where you are and the gifts you've been given. So that's really an essential part of that happiness quotient.
Now, you also do you tend to find what we tend to find is that the people who are most content and most satisfied with their finances tend to be generous people.
Oh yes. So you know, it's a little bit like the loaves and fishes, I guess. That you know, if you start giving things away, remarkably, there are more loaves and fishes there. And generosity is an essential part of that gratitude. That it's a way for you to express the gratitude is to be generous with those around you. And it brings a great deal of additional meaning to life.
So, you know, as we conclude the book, I mean, or we conclude the we're not concluding the book, we're concluding the book interview, what would you want to leave with the listeners as to how to overcome their emotional habits that are affecting their overall investment decisions? What types of things would you want to share with them as to, you know, how to make their investing more from a logical point of view as opposed to just an emotional driven?
So I, you know, bottom line, I think it's so important for folks to be aware of what's making them tick. And the book gives you lots of ways of determining that. But be aware of who you are. Be aware of your values. Be aware of what is most important. One of the most important questions that you can ask yourself or a wealth advisor can ask a client is, what is the purpose of this money? And that will help frame your decisions in terms of how it's invested, and will give you a guideline in terms of managing that successfully over time.
Yeah, that's excellent advice, and we say to our clients all the time is your goals and objectives should drive your investment decisions, not just trying to make more money. You know, what are you trying to accomplish? And, you know, most people never think about that, do they?
No. And it's a sad thing because, you know, it's as if we're on a treadmill. We can't stop and give ourselves the time to reflect on that. But that's what life is all about.
So, Chris, it's chriswhiteauthor.com. Is that correct?
That's correct, chriswhiteauthor.com, and there's a lot of extra material there. Some of it is quite entertaining, so
good.
Enjoy yourself. Yeah.
Well, we appreciate it. Chris White, chriswhiteauthor.com, if you want to follow Chris more. And, Chris, we really appreciate you being here with us and spending this hour explaining your book, Emotional Investor by Chris White, and it's well worth every minute of the read.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.